Hero mode. I'm Jeff Cotton.
This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yehiyas Wuhib in Washington. Here's what's coming up on Africa News Tonight.
This exercise is very important for us in the East African community, because if we don't do that, some people are going to swallow us.
That was Lieutenant General Peter Elwolu, Deputy Chief of Uganda's Defense Forces, on the Six Nation military exercise currently underway that is aimed at cooperation and security operations in East Africa. Details coming up. Also, Mali's military government says it will transition to civilian rule by 2024. These stories and more ahead on African News Tonight. We start with our top story. The Nigerian town of Owo is slowly recovering from the stunning attack on the St. Francis Catholic Church during Sunday Mass, with doctors working on those injured from explosions and gunfire. Authorities have not yet released a death toll, though it has been reported that at least 50 people, including children, died. For an update on the situation, my colleague Douglas Mpuga reached out to reporter Hassan Umaru Tambuwal at the scene in southwest Nigeria.
Yes, people are still coming out gradually. The problem that it causes higher tension has gone down now, because people are out. Although businesses and government work like banks, schools, market have not officially opened. But let's say small work or market people, or like let's say workers, although workers are not out yet, but market has started coming out gradually. You can see some of these specific traders hawking. You can see people flowing out. But if you look at their faces, you see that they are still sad. Most of these people are not moving freely, because you know, the incident that happened is a very serious incident that it may take time before people come to their normal life. Although there's no problem now, it's only in some areas that you cannot see many people, most especially the northern area where northern people are living. But the security are still doing their work. You can see them in the strategic places. They are there with the report, monitoring people, moving up and down.
We hear the police is going on with investigations. What are you hearing from the authorities in as far as the investigation is concerned?
Up to now, the police are going on with the investigation. But there's no actual number of figures from the police, officially the people killed. I called the PPRO, Fumilayo, the police public relations officer today. She said up to now they are investigating and that people are doing all what they can do in their offices to see that, yes, they tackle this and catch the culprits and bring them to book. But up to now, they are still insisting on investigation. Whatever you ask police, they will tell you they are investigating. That's where we are now.
That was the reporter Hassan Umaru Tambuwal speaking with my colleague Douglas Mpuga from the town of Owo. Mali's military government says it will implement a transition to civilian rule in 2024. The government's two-year plan was previously rejected by Western African nations, but may be reconsidered at the summit of the regional bloc ECOWAS next month. Annie Risenberg reports from Bamako, Mali.
Mali's military government announced late Monday evening that it has set up a 24-month timeline for a transition to civilian rule. Government spokesman Colonel Abdoulaye Maiga made the announcement on state TV station ORTM, appearing for the first time in civilian clothing. The video was posted to the ORTM Facebook page.
La durée de la transition est fixée à 24 mois.
He says the duration of the transition is set at 24 months, starting March 26, 2022. March 26 is a public holiday known as Martyrs' Day in Mali, which pays tribute to the dozens of pro-democracy demonstrators who were killed during the overthrow of dictator Moussa Traoré in 1991. MAIGA did not cite a reason for March 26 being chosen as the beginning of the 24-month period. He said the timeline would allow the government to carry out a certain number of institutional political reforms before the organization of elections. The government has previously cited the inability to hold elections in some areas due to insecurity as a reason for extending the transition to civilian rule. Mali's junta, which seized power in a 2020 coup, has been in talks with regional bloc ECOWAS since January, after ECOWAS imposed sanctions on Mali over a government plan to extend the transition until 2026. During an ECOWAS summit in March, Mali's neighbors pushed for a 12 to 16-month timeline. ECOWAS refused to lift the sanctions on Mali after the government proposed a shortened timeline of 24 months. At a meeting last week, ECOWAS leaders decided to discuss the sanctions again at a summit on July 3rd. MAIGA said during his address that the government is hopeful the lifting of these sanctions is imminent. Mali is a landlocked state and depends on its West African neighbors for trade. Although the sanctions do not apply to food and fuel, they have hurt Mali's economy, which, like other countries, is dealing with rising prices for food and other necessities. Annie Reisenberg for VOA News, Bamako, Mali.
Two of the three brothers accused of perpetrating some of the world's biggest economic crimes in recent history have been arrested in the United Arab Emirates, the UAE. A commission of inquiry in South Africa recently found that Ajay, Atul and Rajesh Gupta conspired with former President Jacob Zuma to loot the country's state-owned enterprises of at least 500 billion rands. That's almost $33 billion. The alleged crimes, which in South Africa have become known as state capture, happened mostly during the final 4 years of Zuma's nine-year tenure between 2014 and 2018. Darren Taylor reports.
The Guptas moved to South Africa from India in the early 1990s as the country was freeing itself from apartheid. They wasted no time in forging close ties with top members of the African National Congress. Under Nelson Mandela, the ANC formed the country's first democratic government in 1994. The Guptas built a multi-billion dollar business empire, spanning interests in mining, media, and computers. When Zuma became president in 2009, the Guptas and proxy companies suddenly began winning contracts to handle mega projects in government corporations, such as Eskom, South Africa's national electricity provider.
It's quite clear that the Gupta brothers were the architects of state capture, working in cahoots with the former president Jacob Zuma, as well as with a number of other senior political figures.
Lawson Naidu is one of many civil society activists who've been pressing law enforcement agencies, including the National Prosecuting Authority, the NPA, to build cases against the Guptas. An inquiry into state capture has concluded that the brothers, with some leading ANC officials, plundered government entities. Naidu says the Guptas are responsible for South Africa's electricity crisis, for example, because they ran state enterprises into the ground.
We've heard all of this evidence before the Commission of Inquiry. We now need to see action taken. And finally, the NPA are beginning to see the results of their work over many years.
The Guptas fled to Dubai soon after Zuma lost leadership of the ANC and the country to Cyril Ramaphosa. Some of their assets have been frozen in South Africa, but investigators say most of the money they allegedly stole is stashed in overseas bank accounts. Department of Justice representative Crispin Piri says Atul and Rajesh Gupta were arrested on Friday in Dubai using an Interpol red notice, which the International Policing Agency uses to bring fugitives to justice. But Piri says this doesn't mean the Guptas will be in South Africa any time soon.
Extradition requests are not something where you go tap someone on the shoulder and you say, come, let's go. They would be presented to a court of law where the court would be taken into confidence that these individuals, they are believed to be fugitives, and then they would produce the required documents. And often, fugitives of justice would then challenge that extradition request. And sometimes it does take quite a long time to effect. Fugitives of justice won't give up their freedom that easily, and so they would want to challenge every step of the process. So that's something that we should anticipate.
Nevertheless, says the director of the organization Undoing Tax Abuse, Wayne Divinage, South Africans should be happy people today.
Well, we've got a lot of fish to fry, but we should never relent. We should never give up on matters like this, because this is what gives us hope. You know, for too often we hear people saying the Guptas will never be arrested. This proves them wrong. And if we can get the rule of law to flow, if we can get these arrests to happen, then this is stuff that we need to celebrate, because it's all part of the building blocks of getting our country back on track.
Divinage expects the extradition of the Guptas to take a long time, maybe even a couple of years. But he says their arrests mean there must be an awful lot of fear within some ANC circles right now. For VOA News, I'm Darren Taylor in Johannesburg.
About 1,533 personnel from the East African Community member states are taking part in a joint military training exercise in Uganda with a focus on cooperation and security operations in the region. Catherine Nambi reports from Kampala.
Currently underway in three Ugandan districts, the exercise has attracted army, police and prison personnel from the six member states including Uganda, Burundi, Kenya, Tanzania, Rwanda and South Sudan. The newest member to the bloc, the Democratic Republic of Congo, only sent a team of 10 observers. Major General Don Nabasa is the commander of the Uganda People's Defense Forces, UPDF Military Police, and director of the joint training. He says it's aimed at testing the EAC's readiness to jointly tackle emerging security threats such as armed conflicts, transnational crime, and terror threats.
The exercise is based on four thematic areas, which include peace support operations, counter-terrorism, counter-piracy, and disaster management. The expected outcome of this exercise include jointly managed integrated mission headquarters, capable of planning and executing missions jointly, integrated service support architecture, among many others.
Lieutenant General Peter Erelu is the Deputy Chief of UPDF. He has tasked the ESC security organs to work jointly to protect the region's resources from exploitation.
This exercise is very important for us in the East African community, because if we don't do that, some people are going to swallow us. There are some hyenas around watching, because we have so many good things around. We have this water, we have minerals. Some people envy this very much. So if we sleep, they will take over.
Gaspard Banyakimbona is the executive secretary of ESC's Inter-University Council. He notes that the exercise should strengthen information sharing about possible threats in the region and discuss how to combat them.
East African Defense Forces have gone beyond exercises and are operating together in several missions, such as in the African Union Transition Mission in Somalia, and consequently, the objectives of this field training exercise include, among others, to enhance interoperability between the ESC partner states, defense force, and other key stakeholders, and to practice the ESC standing operating procedures for peace support operations, disaster management, and counter-terrorism and counter-piracy operations.
Lydia Wanyoto, the head of mission for the exercise, told the media in Kampala that the training is a good gesture toward fostering cohesion and integration among ESC member states.
When you see these exercises, they are meant to be opening up a progressive cross-border ideological understanding and approach to many things, including peace and security. We are using the competences we have of human diplomacy, because that's where our strength is, our cultural values, our history. We are neighbors, it's only the border that divides us. We speak the same language. The strength of who we are is what we are using in terms of military diplomacy and security.
The joint training is conducted every 2 years on a rotational basis among the member states. It was last held in 2018 in Tanzania. This is Catherine Nambi for VOA News in Kampala.
You're listening to African News Tonight. I'm Yehia Suhib in Washington. Please note that we have moved our programs from voanews.com to voaafrica.com. There, you'll find all your favorite VOA radio and TV programs and a whole lot more. Find us on voaafrica.com. Libya's House of Representatives has called for another meeting today in an effort to install its nominated Prime Minister, Fatih Bashagha, and his government. However, none of the main power stakeholders in Tripoli, such as the Central Bank of Libya and the Western Libya-based militias, recognize the Bashagha administration. The Prime Minister of the Government of National Unity, Abdulhamid Dabiba, stressed that the only option for his government is to hold parliamentary elections as soon as possible. Wolfgang Porstai, former Austrian military attaché in Libya, discussed these developments with VOA senior analyst Mohamed Al-Shenawi.
While it would be certainly desirable for the stability of Libya that Fatih Bashagha could take over as a prime minister because he is a more unifying figure than Dabiba, this is increasingly unlikely. The support, as you've said, or at least the acceptance of the various Tripoli militias, is a precondition for any government residing in Tripoli. And the most powerful militias in Tripoli support Dabiba because he is not only not harming their influence, but he is also partially financing them. And as long as the Central Bank of Libya chair, Al-Sadiq Al-Kabir, is loyal to Dabiba and funds his government, there is absolutely no way that Bashagha can establish a second serious government in Sirte. Currently, while Dabiba hosts talks with mayors, hospital managers and other people from the east, making clear that he is the only one with the money, the significance of Bashagha sitting in Sirte is slowly fading away. He has actually nothing to deliver. With regard to the elections, Dabiba has already proposed in March to have parliamentary elections by the end of the June, which is entirely unrealistic. Now he talks about such elections at the end of this year. However, the HOR election laws are rejected by Dabiba, as it is with the same case with the constitutional declaration. He is seeking a referendum on the controversial draft constitution 2017, while the High National Election Commission says that they will work only according to the laws issued by the House of Representatives. So, despite the promises of Dabiba, I don't believe we will see elections in Libya this year. We will rather see some more violent confrontation.
While chair of the High Council of State, Khaled al-Mishri, stated that he sees a good chance to reach an agreement on 95% of the 2017 draft constitution at the next HOR-HCS meeting in Cairo, but HOR representatives stated that there is no consensus at all on really important issues and reaching an agreement is very unlikely. What's the way out?
Ansmil and Dabiba have unfortunately led Libya into a real dead-end road. There is no solution for all these open questions inside as long as Dabiba is prime minister. It is doubtful that his orders, his eventual orders to organize elections under his conditions would be accepted in Fezzan, let alone in the eastern Cyrenaica. Regarding the constitution, maybe the re-implementation of the 1951 Federalist Constitution, which is now more frequently proposed by representatives of the east, could be a way out. I would say this is a good idea. It could be adopted by a common decision of the House of Representatives and the High Council of State in a slightly amended form, but only as an interim constitution. And it needs to be amended at least with a formula about the distribution of the oil revenues. But to be honest, I doubt that Dabiba would accept this, as he is ignoring the HOR at all. Furthermore, I'm also quite skeptical about the readiness of the High Council of State to go this way.
So what role do you envision for the UN and US?
I would say the UN and the US would need to find an entirely new approach. As I've indicated before, they should discuss with the House of Representatives and the High Council of State to find a consensus about the way forward with the interim constitution, with the 1951 constitution as an interim. This should not be discussed in public. This should be discussed behind closed doors, and this will certainly take some time. But to have such an interim constitution, which would allow to stabilize Libya in its parts, in its three historic provinces, is the only way forward I consider realistic.
That was Wolfgang Poschtei, former Austrian military attaché in Libya, speaking with VOA's Mohamed El-Shenawi. In Zimbabwe, the editor of an online news platform has been charged with insulting the president. The move follows a dramatic week involving an alleged attempted abduction. We have more on the story from Bulawayo.
Dudu Zimatutu, accompanied by his lawyer Ngobani Stole, has handed himself over to the police in Bulawayo. This follows a visit to his home in Machula last week by a man named Nyanete and six others in unmarked vehicles who were looking for him. Matutu has been in hiding while his lawyers were trying to establish the reason for the visit by the seven suspected state security agents. A letter by the lawyers to the police in VOA's possession indicates that police initially distanced themselves from the visit by the man. Matutu is the editor of the online news platform ZimLife. Last year, police stormed his home and arraigned his relatives. They also abducted and tortured his nephew, journalism student Tawanda Mcheiwa. The incident took place just before last July's stairway, which saw the arrest of civil society, opposition and media actors, including Hope Chingono. He tweeted recently that he is still nursing injuries sustained in the alleged abduction. VOA reached out to his lawyer, Ngobani Stole. He revealed that his client is being charged for undermining the authority of the president as defined in Section 33 of the Criminal Law Codification and Reform Act. He has been released pending further investigations and has not appeared in court for purposes of remand. The police will advise the lawyers on when he should appear in court.
The critical question that we have been asking is whether a statement has been recorded from the complainant, who happens to be the president of the republic, and if so, and what is his response regarding the tweet, because the source of the allegation is the tweet.
Sitole says they are yet to establish what roused the anger of the authorities.
If one looks at the tweet as alleged, not that he's admitting nor denying, there is nothing that is insulting or insinuating to be insulting. We are expecting something worse than this, seen as it is that it was coming from the law and order section of the police, and that due to the, as a journalist, he has been reporting, you know, that kind of material that is thought provoking. We strongly believe that there is no substance in the charge.
According to his lawyer, the offending tweet was posted by the journalist on the 17th of May on his Twitter handle. He wrote that he understood that the president had been drinking before making the announcement to suspend all bank lending in the country. The move sent the financial sector into a tailspin and shockwaves, which saw the prices of consumer goods spiraling out of control. A backlash and widespread criticism led the government to drop the ban. Meanwhile, political analysts have condemned the charging of the journalist as heavy-handed. Social political analyst Effie Nwe says the state should normalize countering what it considers to be falsehoods with facts.
This development announces the attitude of the state as we go into the 2023 elections, that it is not going to tolerate any dissenting voices. We expect that more people are going to be arrested. There is going to be a general crackdown on dissenting voices, whether they are from civil society, the media, churches, or the political opposition. The state is not in the mood of accommodating people within the provisions of the Constitution. Instead, it is bent on completely defying the Constitution.
He adds that the development is a harbinger of dark days ahead with the impending elections. Observers and analysts alike agree that the country is poised for more reprisals against those perceived to be opponents of the government. This is VOA in Bulawayo, Zimbabwe.
And that wraps up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Yehiyes Wuhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. On behalf of our producer, Mokbil Yabaro, and our engineer, Rob McLean, thanks for tuning in and choosing the Voice of America.